Greetings and welcome to New Books in History. I am your host, Monica Black, and today I have the distinct pleasure of talking with Karin Henschuh about her book, Terror and Democracy in West Germany, which was just published in 2012 by Cambridge University Press. The book deals with the consequences for West German democracy of the left-wing terror that engulfed that country in the 1970s. In West Germany in September and October of 1977, a group of self-described urban guerrillas of the Red Army faction, or RAF, kidnapped industrialist Hans Martin Schleyer. In exchange for Schleyer, the kidnappers demanded the release of their imprisoned leaders, Andreas Bader and Gudrun Enslin. Those months in 1977 are often referred to as the German Autumn, and they represent in some ways a crescendo of leftist political violence that had its origins almost a decade before. Terror prompted a crisis in the 1970s for the West German government and for German democracy. Of course, 1977 was not the first time in history that a German republic had been tested by a group of radicals intending to bring it down. That had already happened in the 1930s. But 1977 turned out very differently than 1933, when the Nazis captured power in a profoundly embattled and dysfunctional democracy. In fact, as Professor Henschuh argues in her fascinating book, quote, West Germany's terrorist crisis helped to usher in the relatively stable civil society that still defines Germany today, end quote. Karin Henschuh is Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University, and I am absolutely delighted to have the chance to speak with her today about her book and about the meaning of the German autumn for German democracy. Welcome, Karin.
Thank you very much, Monica.
Yeah, it's really nice to talk to you, and I just found your book wonderful and fascinating.
Thank you. I appreciate hearing that.
Good. Listen, I wonder if you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself, about your background, maybe about your education, anything that our listeners might find interesting.
Sure. Well, I got my degree from the University of Chicago in modern European history. I came to this project kind of roundabout through a seminar I took there, and it sent me, obviously, to Europe to do field work. I spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. There's an Institute of Social History there that everyone should go to, in my opinion. It's a fabulous kind of treasure trove of left history. Spent a good deal of time in party archives. My project, this book definitely draws on a lot of non-archival sources. So there was definitely some kind of scurrying about basements of Berlin, looking in old journals and whatnot. What more do I say?
Let me ask you something.
Excuse me?
No, I was along the lines of sources. I was just wondering about... just as a point of curiosity, you know, the privacy laws, of course, are very strict in Germany concerning particularly the recent past and the access that scholars can have to documents. So was that in any way difficult for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It meant that, yeah, government documents of any kind were off limits. I mean, when I first went over, I know the archivists basically threw up their hands and said, we have nothing for you. So that is in some ways what shaped this project, in that I then determined very early on that I was going to look at the public debate about terrorism, about violence that occurred, largely because I wasn't going to get at the kind of behind the doors debate. I mean, gradually that has opened up and I've gotten more and I found ways to get around it in that private papers, say, of Hans-Jürgen Vogel, who was the interior minister. His stuff was already open and readable at the Social Democratic Archive. So there were ways to get around it, but absolutely, the 30-year ban is a significant one and certainly determined the course of what I did.
Yeah, I can imagine. Maybe, Karin, could you tell us, you know, some of our listeners will be familiar with this kind of... history of left-wing violence, left-wing political violence in the 1970s, not just, of course, in West Germany, but, of course, in Italy, the United States, and other places, too. But I wonder if, as a background for those folks who are less familiar with this history, if you could tell us a bit about what the German Autumn was and why that's sort of a culminating point in some ways of a process that had been set in train years beforehand, actually.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the German Autumn, so just maybe to first think about it in popular memory, the German Autumn is remembered as a time of crisis, largely. Some people describe it as a time of hysteria, where Germans were basically, German democracy hung in the balance. People waited around to see basically if the state was going to revert to kind of its fascist authoritarian tendencies and come down very hard in its attempts to confront terrorism, basically destroy democracy in its attempt to supposedly save it. Others kind of waited with bated breath to basically see if the state just utterly failed, not because it was too strong, but because it was too weak. So there's a lot of, you get a lot of past and present kind of fears running amok, basically, in the German Autumn, where people aren't really confident, aren't sure what is going to happen because they're not confident about the state itself. Whether the Federal Republic of Germany or the FRG has really accomplished its task to become a democratic Germany, or if it has these kind of lingering fascist tendencies that will come out in times of crisis. And others look and would point to the terrorists, the left-wing radicals who basically take up guns in 1970, declare war on Germany because they see it as a fascist state. Many West Germans in the late 70s are increasingly convinced that it's these terrorists, these so-called urban guerrillas that are the real fascists. And there's a great fear that the state can't control them and that it will be brought down just like it was in Weimar. So during the 1930s, as you mentioned in your introduction, that we're going to get a repeat of Weimar and the destruction of democracy by these fringe radicals. And so really the German Autumn, it's this amazing moment where, or as I conceive of it, where Germans are fighting the phantoms of the past, whether it's National Socialism or the collapse of Weimar, just as much as they are fighting the present terrorist attacks. And it's a lot in my mind about just trying to see, kind of distinguish truth, whatever, the reality from these past fears, these lingering fears about democracy in Germany.
Yeah, so the ghosts of the past are very much present in all the debates about terrorism in the 70s.
Yeah.
Can you say, I know this is a bit of a, this is a very fractious topic, without a doubt, but I wonder if you can say something about what is the relationship? I mean, that left-wing political violence begins in the early 70s is important because, of course, there is some kind of link between the student movement and what comes after, but I realize this is a very contentious subject, but could you maybe, just for people who maybe are a little bit less familiar, could you say something about that debate?
Yeah, I'll throw myself on the fire here.
No, you don't have, just tell us what the two sides claim about
okay.
it, maybe.
So the first attack could be said to have actually started, to have taken place in 1968. Gudrun Ensslin and Andreas Bader, along with two others, set fire to two department stores in Frankfurt in kind of solidarity with Vietnam, with the declaration that, with the intent of bringing the war home, to kind of shake West Germans out of their kind of complacency. It's certainly, that act comes, is very much at home with kind of conversations, frustrations that are occurring in the student movement, growing disillusionment with West Germany's ongoing support of American actions in Vietnam. So the first act of terror definitely comes out of conversations and critiques of present day society, consumer society, as well as West German society in particular. And really, I mean, I guess I see, for me, the student movement, I mean, and actually I would want to broaden it, the protests of the 60s, you know, involved an incredibly wide variety of actors. So maybe, you know, critical older leftists born long before the baby boomers joined a spectrum of middle-aged to younger, to definitely student-aged protesters. And, you know, they start very peacefully. They confront police truncheons, a lot of police violence. Protests increasingly get more and more violent. In the late 60s, you reach kind of a crisis point when they are not achieving any of their goals. And the question of how do we move things forward? How do we accomplish? How do we get our voices heard? How do we defend democracy from what we perceive to be undemocratic kind of status quo personalities? And the question of violence comes up then and there. In that the question here is, I mean, there's a strong sense on the left that every German citizen after 1945 has a responsibility, a duty to resist fascism, the resurgence of authoritarian behavior in any form, and that this includes violent resistance. And I mean, I think this is not, I mean, this becomes something that former student activists are kind of loath to embrace, that they would have ever contemplated violence. But I think, honestly, it's rather understandable if you think that the monster you're potentially facing is fascism or some approximation of it. And if the stakes are democracy itself, I don't think that's so beyond the pale. But anyway, it becomes a point of strategy, a big strategy debate at the end of the 60s. The vast, vast, vast majority of protesters reject violence. Not so much on principle, but looking around, they just don't think the conditions in West Germany are such that we're at that moment where revolution is essentially called for. But a small group, such as the RAF, the Red Army faction, as well as the 2nd of June movement, decide differently. Basically, are so frustrated and have concluded that, as Gudrun Ensing says, there's no talking to this generation, the older generation, the Auschwitz generation, that only action will kind of solve the crisis. So they break off, you could say, kind of from the mainstream protest movement and take up war. Because they have so much of a political history, social history, a lot of the social networks that the RAF comes out of are these old protest networks. They have a lot of sympathy from this kind of extra parliamentary left because they share these student movement ties, but also because a lot of their critiques of current society seem to be dead on. And because there is a lot of suspicion that the state is not particularly democratic, or at least it's not living up to its democratic ideals. So I feel that's a bit of a long-winded answer, but I mean, they do have their roots there. The hot flash point of debate is basically that this then in itself becomes an issue and a fighting point. When they're trying to deal with terrorism, conservatives definitely blame then the student movement, kind of eager to roll back kind of the cultural revolution of the 60s. Conservatives definitely point the finger at then the protests of the 60s and lay a lot of blame for the violence of the 70s on the goals and politics of the 60s. And for very clear reasons, you can imagine activists of the 60s are rather resistant to being fingered for that one. So that's basically where the debate breaks down.
Yeah, it's great. It's great to have that background. I'm sure that that will, I mean, that background certainly informs your book in very important ways, I think. And I think maybe if I could ask you now about another aspect of background, another aspect of the kind of crucial historical context here, which is, and I think this is one of the great strengths of your book. The more I think about it, I think this is one of the most important things. That, you know, there's an assumption that it's not just an assumption. I mean, it's a real thing. In the 1970s, that people, that their fears were clearly informed by the semi-recent past of the 1930s. But actually, there are ways in which debates about democracy and what democracy was and whether or not it was good for Germany were much older than debates in the 1970s, certainly, and debates in the 1930s. They went back a lot further than that. And I wondered if maybe you could talk about some of that background, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, you could say that Germany's troubled past or troubled relationship with democracy is very longstanding. It's always, I mean, you could start back with the French Revolution and when the kind of air of democracy first blew over the German lands. And there was, I mean, even though it, I mean, Germans don't get a democratic republic until 1918, they talked about it a lot, debated its pros and cons and whether it was fit for the German lands. And Germany, once it united in 1871. And by and large, people said no. And of course, these are elites who probably aren't incredibly interested in letting go of not just. You know, the same people who are pushing for liberal constitutions are also leery of opening government to the masses. And some of this has to do with Germany's kind of geopolitical situation. There's a sense that, I mean, a universal sense, not one just for Germans, but that democracy is, when it comes down to it, a rather weak government. In that, I mean, at times of crisis, and this is the sticking point, at times of crisis, democracy is really inefficient. It's slow. Parliamentary democracy gets in the way of quick, decisive action. And basically for the Germans, wedged between France and Russia, there's a sense that they just don't have that luxury. The democracy is very much a luxury, a peacetime luxury. And Germany, as an embattled country, it's just not really a good place for it. Now, after 1945, there are no alternatives. And so whether they are really sold on democracy or not, West Germans embrace it as the one answer. The Allies make it pretty clear they don't have another one. Even so, there's this lingering doubt, and Weimar's collapse does nothing to help this. There's this lingering doubt that a democracy cannot withstand a moment of it, of crisis, cannot endure, say, war, revolt, internal revolt, or economic crisis, and all their experience with democracy, however short it was, kind of confirms this for them. So this, in a way, I mean, this is the lingering, yeah, much longer historical kind of ghost, you could say, I guess, the Germans are battling against. This fear that, whether it's because there aren't enough Germans who are Democrats or because the state itself as a democracy is too weak, that if it confronted with a state of exception, that it will just collapse.
Right. Yes. And I thought one of the interesting responses, or what? How shall I put this? One of the really interesting chapters in your book, and this is going back again to the question of roots of what happened in the 1970s, the roots of discourses about democracy and particular forms of democracy and what democracy's responses can be legitimately to terror and violence, whether internal or external. One of the really interesting chapters and one from which I learned the most, I would have to say, in your book was a discussion that you had about militant democracy, which is really a key term in your book. And you talk about the development of the idea of militant democracy by, in particular, German emigre scholars, people who had been forced to leave Germany in the Nazi era. And I wonder if you could talk about those emigres and their ideas about militant democracy and why that's kind of a key word for you in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, militant democracy, the way I see it is that militant democracy and resistance are kind of two sides of the same coin. They are the answers that Germans come up with in 1945, specifically 1949, and so West Germans come up with to answer this fundamental kind of distrust that democracy can withstand its enemies. So Widerstand, resistance, is the civilian answer. Everyone's that the population itself must mobilize to protect democracy. If you don't have Democrats, you don't have a democracy. And then the other, the one that's codified and is the basis for the West German constitution, is militant democracy. So even today, Germany, it considers itself a militant democracy. And the term is coined, as you say, by two emigres, Karl Löwenstein and Karl Mannheim, in the late 30s, early 40s. So at the time that fascism is at its height. They're looking, kind of diagnosing the problem. Why did all these lovely little democracies that bloomed in the interwar period fall away so quickly? And why is fascism, and they're also often looking at Soviet communism, why is Soviet communism so popular? And how can democracy kind of recalibrate itself to become a real contender once more in this ideological battle? So Löwenstein and Mannheim have different answers to this. And in a way, the reason why I lay this down in the book is because, roughly speaking, the conservatives, so in Parliament, the Christian Democrats, map onto Löwenstein's kind of vision of militant democracy. And roughly speaking, the Social Democrats map onto Mannheim's. And so kind of just briefly, like I guess I would say the two kinds of militant democracy that are pursued are one, the Löwensteinian one, the Christian Democratic one, is one that conceives of crisis as something to be managed temporarily and to not kind of wring your hands too much about if you have to temporarily put aside democratic principles. It's an I guess I would say the first kind is a very emergency management devil may care. That's not quite true, but it's basically, you know, we're not going to let democracy hang by its principles. So it's a very pragmatic, in the moment of crisis, it is perfectly acceptable to put parliamentary power on hold so as to empower the executive, because ultimately by putting power in the hands of one strong man, we can most effectively manage the state of exception. They also then, Löwenstein and then the Christian Democrats later, tend to find it perfectly acceptable to temporarily suspend certain civil liberties. Again, I mean, this is all about trying to figure out how you're going to effectively confront your enemies. And they all have Weimar in their head. And the way the Nazis use democracy, use their civil liberties to destroy democracy. Mm. So Löwenstein and the Christian Democrats are very keen on denying, basically, enemies those tools. So civil liberties like freedom of speech, censorship, this sort of thing is perfectly fine in the moment. And then certainly coercive force, whether that is, harsher criminal sentencing, extended police powers, what have you. So that's the one side. And you could say it's kind of the strong arming, but swift acting kind of form of militant democracy. And it's definitely the one that then, if you talk about militant democracy today, that's probably the form most people think of. The Christian Democrats are in power until 1969. So they really basically get the chance to kind of establish their version of militant democracy. Now, the Social Democrats, kind of following the path of Mannheim, understand that militant democracy, the way to make a democracy militant, they pursue it as a more holistic project. They're very keen on making sure that parliament, as opposed to the executive, is the guarantor of the state. But really, they're in it for the long haul. They don't think of this as a temporary situation. They think that the best defense of democracy comes from entrenching democracy in the institutions and in the people. So you could say they're really keen on social engineering is what they are. Political education is one of their major tools. Again, they really believe that if you do not have a population that will fight for democracy, you might as well throw in the towel. So they're very intent on making Democrats, essentially active Democrats. They're also for prevention. Social Democrats and Mannheim would basically just like to rule out the whole option of crisis. They would like to avoid the situation altogether. And so they feel like tinkering with creating the right social conditions will help eliminate that possibility. So economic crisis can be eliminated by using the state to, you know, redistribute income. The state can be used in all sorts of, I guess, ways to kind of manage society and then hopefully preclude the idea of crisis altogether. So, yeah, so we have a temporary kind of strong-arming, a swift form of militant democracy on one side, and then we have this kind of long durée, let's prevent it altogether, but by using the state to help create a democratic culture.
You know, reading that part of your book and reading about Mannheim and Löwenstein and learning all of that. I mean, to me, that was one of the great benefits for me of reading your book was that it made me think about our own present differently. And in a way, I think that's the great contribution of, you know, what the Germans call contemporary history, right? Mm-hmm. The history of the very recent past is that your book helped me think about our own present in the United States and in the world, really. In light of recent events of terrorism and political violence in different ways. It gave me different tools for seeing what's happened in our own country. And so I want to thank you for that. That was very, very helpful for me.
Well, if that's true, then I'm that right there. I'm glad I wrote the book. Thank you.
Right, absolutely. I wonder if you could say kind of in that vein, one of the central, maybe the central claim of your book is that terror, as I said at the outset of our conversation, the terror of the late 70s in West Germany in some ways helped to create the stable, and I think of the Federal Republic as an imminently stable civil society, an imminently stable democracy. And I wonder if you could explain for the listeners exactly how that works out. I mean, how does terror help produce, in a certain sense, a stable democracy?
Yeah, it's a bizarre claim. So first I should say that for the left especially, they do not experience, say, the German autumn and this confrontation with terrorism in a positive light. And they, to this day, would find my interpretation of its contribution probably a bit at odds with their experiences. But, you know, having the privilege of stepping back and putting the German autumn in this much longer context. I can say that, I mean, this uncertainty about democracy and this constant questioning. I mean, so I said, you know, they set up these two kind of answers to the perceived weaknesses of democracy in 1949. They've got the militant democracy and resistance. And this creates essentially a dynamic in West Germany, post-war West Germany, where you could say just of hyper vigilance. I mean, Germans are looking for the state to either prove itself too weak, too strong, for signs of fascism to erupt, whether in the population or within the government. And so it's in a way, it's a police policed and self-policing society, everyone is very nervous for good reason. That kind of the failure to make a sharp break with National Socialism means that they have failed to kind of put to bed the possibilities of fascism's revival in the future. So for me, in the German Autumn, why this become such a kind of turning point is that a lot of these questions are ultimately worked through or answered kind of ultimately in the heat of the moment in crisis. I mean, the extra parliamentary left, who I talked about as having definite political sympathies with the ROF, the terrorists, even if they don't actually support their actions, they're forced to basically confront whether or not the state is illegitimate. You know, they're in a moment of whether of that they have to decide, okay, is this like, you know, 1933? Is this the moment where Widerstand, where resistance is absolutely necessary because the state is fascist? Or is this a liberal democracy, which I may not be so keen on, and I certainly, it's not my ideal definition of democracy, but is it legitimate? And I think, you know, by experiencing the dynamic of escalating violence, because you have the terrorist attack and then you have the state counterattack, right? And it just keeps, I mean, one of the things that's everyone can agree on is that the ROF helped arm the state, no doubt about it. Because with each attack, the state kind of, you know, passed another sort of measure in an attempt to regain control. So the extra parliamentary left, the people who had stood out, and it's not an insignificant part of the population, it's certainly not a majority, no way, but not insignificant minority of people who had stood back kind of this whole time, skeptical of the legitimacy of the state, you could say have a certain kind of pragmatic clarity where they realize that resistance is not, in this form, is certainly not called for. And that their constant kind of standing outside of mainstream society and kind of fantasies of the need for violent resistance have prevented them from what they hope to achieve in many ways, from engaging with mainstream society and changing it. So for me, the experience of terrorism forces kind of a reconceptualization of what resistance is in the FRG, or what it can be. Before, it was something always in opposition to the state. After the late 70s, you see a real turning, a real attempt to re-engage, and in a sense that that basically the state is reformable, so that you can work within it. And so you see a re-engagement of mainstream society through the founding, say, most notoriously of the Greens Party, which definitely is a product. It's not an accident that one of their platforms is nonviolence. They come out of this moment. So does the leftist alternative newspaper, the Tots. So that's kind of one reconceptualization of democracy as it exists in the FRG that occurs. And then I see similar clarification of the state of things on the right. So for conservatives as well as social democrats. I mean, for conservatives, you could say just the fact that the state actually succeeded in confronting terrorism, that it was not brought down. For some conservatives, especially on the far right, this in itself is revelatory and really calms a lot of these constant fears and this dialogue that the state needs to be arming itself. And the conservatives throughout the terrorist crisis, not just the German Autumn, but since the first attack, have been spurring the social democrats who are in government on and critiquing them for being too soft on terrorism, essentially. And in a way, the Christian Democrats sit back for a second and can appreciate, well, they probably don't appreciate, but at least they know that the state hasn't collapsed. There has been no right-wing coup then, military coup. And so 33, or in that case, 1920, has not occurred again. The Social Democrats have their own kind of reckoning, and this is getting long-winded, so I'll try to summarize a little faster. But the Social Democrats, you know, their conception of militant democracy, which really is best understood as internal security, is kind of their program for militant democracy that they instituted in 69. You know, they had put... The Social Democrats are kind of in between the conservatives and the extra parliamentary left, not just in obvious ways, but also in that they're split. They have a lot of faith in the state, but at the same time, they distrust it. They see that democracy can be harmed both by the population and by a too strong state, by the abuse of state power. So they lay down very specific lines on what they find acceptable for a government to do in confronting its enemies. Originally, they say civil liberties are completely off the table. We will not suspend civil liberties. They're very against the use of coercive force, various things. They prefer to kind of continue to perfect laws and to perfect police power, so preventative policing, than to move closer to the CDU's and Loewenstein's answers. But a lot of this starts to change. And I would say in the German autumn, you see most of their kind of previous limits fall by the wayside. In the moment of kind of confronting terrorism, and specifically in the German autumn, they help pass a law, the contact ban, so that completely undermines the suspected terrorist and the convicted terrorist rights to attorney, because it cuts them off completely from the outside world. I mean, they make these radical decisions to undermine civil liberties, and in the final act, they actually mobilize German paramilitary power abroad for the first time in West German history. So they actually mobilize the GSG-9 in an effort, a successful effort, to rescue the hijacked plane Landshut. That's kind of the culmination and end of this spectacular terrorist crisis. So in that, I mean, they come to basically, I mean, the Social Democrats have always fought suspicions that they are not incredibly loyal to the state. I mean, this goes back to the 19th century. I mean, socialists, whether they're internationalists, they're not good, you know, they're not strong Germans, or because, again, they're constantly, they are critics of militarism, of a lot of German history. You know, they're always, the card that the conservatives always whipped out was basically, you know, the Social Democrats, they're socialists, so they're suspicious in the beginning, but they also just, they're not capable of governing. And this is what the SPD then kind of, for them, this is their crowning moment by confronting terrorism in 77 successfully. They prove that they are a party that is not afraid to govern. And Brandt, Willy Brandt, the party leader, consistently calls upon them to prove this great act. And they do so in ways some of their own kind of self-doubts are dispelled. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's often interpreted that the Social Democrats, the Christian Democrats, extra-parliamentary left, all these changes or all of this comes about from fear, that people are acting on plain fear or hysteria, as I mentioned earlier. And I think the Social Democrats, I think they're basically, I mean, maybe they drank their own Kool-Aid, but they think that they have actually successfully democratized the state. In their 10 years in power, that holistic kind of approach to militant democracy that I talked about earlier, they put in a program for pursuing that. And I think that they're able to to mobilize a military, paramilitary force, and to kind of clamp down on civil rights because they've convinced themselves that the West Germany is more democratic than it was 10 years before, and that their GSG9 in their blue jeans and black leather jackets are nothing like the Prussians, and certainly not Nazis.
Certainly not the Gestapo.
Not the Gestapo.
Or some, right.
Yeah.
No, so the entire political landscape, I mean, that's such a fascinating, you know, artifact of this moment, is that the entire political landscape is so transformed. I mean, from the far left to the far right. I wonder if you could, as one of a sort of maybe a point of interest about contemporary German society, about society today in the FRG, is the German autumn a topic? I mean, it's one of those things. It's so interesting to me as a person, you know, spends a lot of time in Germany, spends a lot of time reading about Germany, how often, particularly I would say in the last 10 years, it's been really amazing how mm-hmm. often, you know, you see art exhibits that have to do with the RAF and that history, or films having been made about the Baader-Meinhof gang, so-called. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the meaning of the German autumn is for people in the Federal Republic today. What's the memory of it, or how do people engage with it, if at all, today?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, part of my task when I started this project was in a way figuring out why it was such a topic of conversation still, why it lingered on. But yet, you know, there was no sense of why it was so important. There was just, you know, so is it just nostalgia? You know, is it terrorist chic? I mean, there was definitely kind of a whole fashion made after the Baader-Meinhof aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so then I've attempted to come up with my own answer to this question. But it's, you know, the way people remember it, I mean, a lot of them, you know, self-described leftists remember it as a very dark moment, I think, as a whole. At least, you know, for them, it's a time of government repression. You know, the flip side of trying to create active Democrats is anyone who doesn't really adhere to your definition of Democrat, you know, under the lines of militant democracy, which is, in its definition, it is not neutral. It is not passive. It is very actively promoting its own agenda. In actively promoting its agenda, you get a hunt for sympathizers that both the government and conservatives really participate in the 70s. That is the memory for a lot of leftists. Sense of censorship, a fear of speaking their mind. And then it's I think though the reason why it still lives on is because it is one of these first battlegrounds for defining the legacy of 1968. She has two daughters, Ulrike Meinhof, and one of her daughters has been really, I mean, the conservatives love her. She, in rather untimely moments, she will bring out some picture. Famously 2001, a picture of Joschka Fischer, who is the minister of, what do we call this?
Foreign minister.
Foreign minister, thank you.
No, it's okay.
He was the foreign minister at the time. She hauls out a picture of him hitting a policeman over the head with a rock or whatever. And she'll release interesting tidbits about her mom, usually only basically as part of what feels like a smear campaign to 68ers. The conservatives have definitely done their best to draw a direct link between terrorism and the student movement. And that is still what these debates tend to be about. It's this hashing out of what this connection is. And I think, the fact that these art exhibits still have such a resonance, I mean, I think no one has really kind of hashed out the importance of violence to the student movement. But also, I mean, mostly to the student movement. Things have changed a good deal. I would say 10 years ago, when I kind of first started floating, when I was first working on this, I was met with a lot of resistance. And there was a tendency to read my work as either being for or against. So either for the student movement, 68ers, for the left, or against it. And I noticed when I was back just this year that now there's a general sense, there's an admission that violence, the fantasies of violence and very real kind of acts of violence are something that the student movement, the protest movement has to deal with, that were real, are part of its history. But there is now kind of a confrontation and working through it that I wonder if we'll see less and less of a fascination with the German Autumn as a result. I'm not sure. I mean, as they work through it, it becomes less of a weapon for conservatives to use against them, I think. But it has, I mean, the whole thing, it is very alive. I guess I consider one of my crowning achievements is that I've been accused of both being a neoconservative and as being a terrorist sympathizer. So my analysis seems to please neither the right nor the left. So,
which must mean you're hitting on something.
Something, I guess.
Right. No, that's wonderful. Well, I mean, you're a very busy person and you've been very generous with your time today. And I appreciate that enormously. And our listeners will too. I wonder if maybe here as a conclusion, if you could tell us a little bit about your next project and how maybe a little bit about what you're working on and how it's taken shape.
Okay. Well, I'm on the, just in the early stages of it. What I hope will be actually a fun project. It'll be a social, political, also cultural history of Germany's relations with Italy, largely post 45. I see it 1943 to 1990, roughly. It will in my ideal, it will be an entangled history. So it will involve the Italians as well as the Germans. But definitely a post-war relationship. I think the Italians have been quite crucial, or at least the imagination of Italy, or the German imagination of Italy has been quite crucial in helping Germans kind of reconstruction, honestly, moral rehabilitation, as well as kind of economic and political reconstruction. I don't think it's something that's been delved into all that much. It tends to get folded into kind of longer German romances with Italy that, you know, go back a little further than Goethe, but there's certainly that the kind of Sehnsucht for Italy. And I think there's something actually a very, very post-1945 story that will involve, you know, Italian guest workers' position in West German society, but also, say, our disillusioned 68ers who go to Italy, form communes there, or, you know, as politicians, buy a house in Tuscany and live there because they think the air is freer in Italy. So anyway, this is the next project is I'm going to enjoy it, and it's still a little ill-defined, but...
No, it sounds fantastic. And I mean, we don't get to, let's be honest, in 20th century German history, we don't often get to do a lot of fun projects. So
yeah. I think I'm looking for a little light after terrorism. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I hope you'll also get to take some trips to Italy. That would be nice.
Yeah. That's hopefully in the future. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Karin Henschuh, thank you so much. The book is called Terror and Democracy in West Germany. It was published in 2012 by Cambridge University Press. It is at once a political history of the FRG, the Federal Republic of Germany. It is a history of democracy, a history of political theory in the abstract and in practice. And it is a history of social movements, among many other things. I learned so much from it, and I think that you will too. Karin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.